You're listening to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Here with a fresh perspective on the market, the economy, and your money. From the Spokane office of the Opus 111 Group, Mike Mayle.
Thank you. Welcome again to our weekly gathering of financial common sense, providing you an alternative to conventional wisdom. We're here to talk with you about the markets and the economy, things that happened this past week that could affect your investment decisions, and try to provide you some insight into what is really important and what is perhaps just a little bit noise. Now, before we get too far into the data, etc., I want to say, first of all, happy Easter to everyone. I hope you and your family have a fine holiday. And also, unfortunately, as I'm recording this, it is prior to the Zags playing. And so, just always and forever, go Zags, right? Those guys are good. And effective Monday, I will not be doing the morning reports on the station early on the drive time anymore. The station's decided to go a different way, and so I get to sleep in. But I will continue these Saturdays, and perhaps a little change in format going forward, but nonetheless, we will be doing it, and I hope you will continue to listen and hopefully learn from some of the things we're talking about. Now, this past week, we did see all-time highs set. It was like, who could set the next all-time high? And for example, the Russell 2000 at a 52-week high, all-time highs from the Dow and the S&P on Thursday, and also on a non-inflation adjusted basis, an all-time high by gold as well. So the numbers on Friday were the Dow closing at 39,807, S&P ended at 52.54, the NASDAQ ended the day at 16,379, Russell 2000 at 21.24, 10-year Treasury. It was bid at 4.20%. Crude was at $83.17 a barrel. Soft white wheat ticked up to $5.74 a bushel. Gold settled at $22.47 an ounce, with silver at $29.06 an ounce. Come Monday, we have the start of the second quarter, and we're going to be getting a bunch of the turn-of-the-month economic reports this next week, and all the traders are going to be watching those with steely eyes. We get the manufacturing index Monday, the JOLTS report, job openings report, on Tuesday, followed by private sector payroll on Wednesday, and then come Friday, we get the March jobs report. So all of those are going to be watched with keen eyes. Now, in today's broadcast, I want to talk about a few comments about the economy, some reports that came out this week, address a little bit about elections, again, not who to vote for, but some thoughts that might help keep you from getting too confused by the markets going into this period of time. We'll have some outlook comments about what a number of people from around the country think is happening in the marketplace, as well as providing you some perspectives about the aforementioned market. So, let us jump into this bad boy. Orders for long-lasting goods, those are called durable goods orders, rose in by 1.4% in Feb. That was higher than what the economists had predicted. That's according to Street Account. And the core orders were up higher than expected as well. Now, if you've been buying Easter candy, well, shoot, any candy that's got chocolate in it, you've perhaps noticed that the prices are up rather significantly. Well, the reason for that is that cocoa prices have hit record levels, well, pretty much on a regular basis. But on Tuesday, they crossed above $10,000 a metric ton for the first time ever. So why so high? We've got dry weather conditions, wildfires, and something called the cacao swollen shoot virus have all helped move the commodity to these levels. Year to date, cocoa prices are up 139%. So your Cadbury egg and your little chocolate Easter bunny are going to be, you may want to put those on a shelf and say, oh yeah, look at that. So, changing gears, since 1970, U.S. consumption of crude and petroleum products has increased by only 38%, with our economy expanding by 4.2%. So, oil consumption per unit of output has fallen by two-thirds. So, do we really need to regulate internal combustion engines out of existence? Well, there's a lot of very confused people that seem to think so. So, and another topic, the Fed did release the Feb money supply data. No one welcomed surprises. The M2, which is pretty much all the money that's in the, floating around out in the system, continues to shrink relative to the overall economy, and that's the main reason inflation is likely to continue to fall. And most important is the fact that if money supply and money demand are about in balance, seems to be the case. I think no reason to expect any meaningful change in inflation. You know, many are going to call this a soft landing because it's going to be the first time that the Fed has actually taken inflation down from relatively high levels without also triggering a recession. I think the recession is going to have to call missing persons to see where it went. But in any case, the reason for that is the Fed's what they call abundant reserves policy that avoids creating a shortage of liquidity in the banking system. Now, on Friday, a report came out about what's called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, the PCE index. That's the number that the Fed likes to use primarily for determining which way inflation is going. And the report showed that inflation was pretty much in line with expectations, so that likely keeps the Fed on hold before it can start considering any interest rate cuts. That, by the way, was up, excluding food and energy, 2.8% on a 12-month basis. Rate cuts remaining a probability isn't the same as rate cuts needing to happen soon or to be particularly deep. Markets do quite well during prolonged pauses between the Fed tightening and their easing, and slower, more measured rate-cutting cycles have tended to be better than aggressive ones in which those policymakers are looking to put band-aids on an ailing economy. So we seem to be in good shape there as well. The GDP, gross domestic product, the official scorecard of the economy, grew at 3.4% annualized in the final 3 months of last year. The previous estimate had the economy growing at 3.2%, and those are adjusted for inflation. In addition, helping the economy, consumer spending rose at 3.3% annualized, much faster than the 3% estimated a year ago. And just for compare and contrast, the GDP grew by 2.5% in 23 compared with a 1.9% in 22. So we're continuing a positive trend, it would appear. Now, about those elections, write this down. Stocks don't care about political parties, personalities, or who says what on social media. They don't care about any viral floor speeches or quotes taken out of context, no, any of the other things that get hashed and rehashed endlessly in certain corners of the reactionary news world. Stocks care about policies, as in, is Congress doing or considering anything big and radical that could redraw property rights, change the rules of commerce, otherwise interfere with the potential return on a new investment? Is there a high likelihood of any new legislation creating winners and losers? When we have extreme gridlock like we do today, the answer is as close to a blanket no as possible. And that no is really a big yes for the markets. It gives businesses and investors the clarity they crave. It frees them to deploy capital as they see fit. It removes the uncertainty overhang that might otherwise weigh on their risk-taking. It also omits the drag that comes when those legislations losers feel the pain twice as much as the bill's beneficiaries are enjoying their win. And it all shows in our markets moving higher without those legislative risks standing in the way. You know, today's headlines will tell you the AI hype and rate cut hopes are the driving forces behind our stock returns so far, the reasons why the S&P is already at double digits in the year before where our first quarter is over. And yet the reality is stocks are doing what they pretty much always do and have always done in the latter half of any president's term after the midterms have boosted gridlock. You know, political risk isn't absent, given the election's lingering wild cards and the fact that a lot of rulemaking happens outside Congress and what they call the regulatory state these days. However, that congressional gridlock is a powerful control on a big variable, and for stocks, it's happily one less thing to worry about. Now, in presidential election years have typically been pretty good for investors. If we go back to 1928, I have a report here from Hartford Funds, so I'm not making this stuff up. If you go back to 1928 through year-end last year, in the presidential election years that took place over all that period, the average return in the S&P was 11.5%. In all years, it's about 10%. So put another way, stocks had a positive return in 83% of presidential election years. And typically, the first half of the year has done worse than the second half. In the first half, we've had an average return of 2.78%. In the second half, it has been as high as 9.3%. So I don't know if that will repeat itself this year, but what the hey. You know, the biggest mistake folks make during election years, worry about too much about which party gets in. You know, Capital Group economist Daryl Spence said this, and I think he makes a lot of sense. And I'm quoting, "Presidents get far too much credit and far too much blame for the health of the U.S. economy and state of financial markets. There are many other variables that determine economic growth and returns. And frankly, presidents have very little influence over them." Yay, verily. Now, stocks, again, have trended higher regardless of which party has been in office. Now, the second mistake that folks get wrapped up in is you get spooked by primary season volatility, which is hard upon us. You know, markets hate uncertainty. You know, they don't mind if the world's ending or its happy days are here again, but uncertainty, oh no, we can't deal with that. And what's more uncertain than primary season in election year? So volatility caused by this uncertainty is usually short-lived after the primaries are over and each party has selected its candidate, though this year that may be somewhat redundant. Markets have tended to return to their normal upward trajectory and have often bounced back after the volatility of a primary season. You know, and that election year volatility can also bring what you would consider as buying opportunities. Does that mean you should avoid specific sectors? Well, Rob Lovelace of Capital Group, who's been managing portfolios for those folks for 38 years, says, quote, "When everyone's worried that a new government policy is going to come along and destroy a sector, that concern is usually overblown," unquote. Regardless of who wins, stocks with strong long-term fundamentals have often rallied once the campaign spotlight fades. And the third mistake that folks get tripped up by, trying to time the markets around politics. Don't waste your time. It's not going to happen. But folks have typically been more cautious leading up to elections. And this year is no different, as since 1992, investors have been pouring assets into money market funds, lowest risk, lowest return investment vehicles, much more often heading up into the elections. And the stock-oriented funds and ETFs have seen the highest net inflows immediately after an election. So make of that what you will. Well, let's see. What time we got? Well, we're doing okay. Outlook. Here's some comments from analysts and strategists around the country about what they see happening in the marketplace currently. And just to start off, according to Carson Group data, the month of April has historically been a solid one for market returns. Matter of fact, it has been the second best month of the year for the S&P going back to 1950. So let's keep that, hope that continues. Now, this 5-month rally we've been participating in has seen a lot of valuations rise, and some rather nicely. But there's plenty of places in the S&P that are still historically cheap. According to Bloomberg Intelligence, only tech, materials, and industrials as sectors are trading at a premium. So that suggests that perhaps there's opportunities in other sectors. Now, the Wall Street Journal notes that when the S&P 500 has gained more than 8% for the first quarter, it's finished higher for the rest of the year 94% of the time, with an average gain of 9.7% for the final three quarters. Well, we were up 10.2% in the first quarter this year. So I'd say hopefully that looks as if that trend can continue. Now, Tony Dwyer, who is an analyst, said in a note to clients on Monday that the stock market is in one of the longest overbought periods in history, in his opinion. But that doesn't mean stocks have to fall. He said, and I'm quoting, "Typically, such an extreme is followed by a churning market over the short to intermediate term rather than a dramatic pullback. This reinforces their view that buying weakness if and when it comes. We continue to believe that any pickup in volatility over the coming weeks and months should be used to add to the broader market as opposed to the S&P 500. John Stolfus, he's chief investment strategist at Oppenheimer Asset Management, had this to say, and I'm quoting, "For us, the big surprise this year has not been so much the resilience of the economy, but rather the substantial capitulation among the bears and bearish community, as well as improved broader investor sentiment." On Monday, he raised the year-end price target for the S&P to 5,500, which is the highest in Wall Street, and that would imply not much of a gain from here, about 4%, I believe I calculated it. Don't hold me to the math. Now, according to UBS, also in a note this past week, and I'm quoting, "Although some sentiment and positioning indicators suggest a modest pullback in the coming months, UBS continues to believe that the four key equity market drivers remain largely in place, which are solid growth, disinflation, the Fed pivot, and an explosion in AI investment," unquote. The market is broadening out. It's bringing in more of those cyclical sectors, and that's being underpinned by the data that's coming from the economy suggesting it's still in good shape. Inflation's still a little positive and still above target. Tim Hayes, chief global strategist at Ned Davis Research, handicapped what might warn of a market stumble using the firm's array of cyclical sentiment and technical models. Tim said, "As long as rate cuts remain a high probability, the cyclical bull should persist, though not without some volatility ahead. With optimism excessive and the seasonal and cyclical tailwinds fading, keep an eye on the breadth leadership and index concentration for signs that a downturn is underway, most likely a correction that will relieve the optimism and set the stage for the bull market to resume." Well, okay. Now, Savita Subramanian, dang it, I can't get Savita's name right to save my life. Savita is the Bank of America U.S. equity strategist, and she had this to say about the market. "I think the one bear case that I hear that I want to try to debunk is the idea that the market is too expensive. Folks today will take the S&P and compare it to 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. She says, "I don't think that makes sense because the market today is such a different animal. The S&P 500 is half as leveraged, is of higher quality, and has lower earnings volatility than prior decades. Main reason? Well, the index has shifted from 70% of very asset-intensive manufacturing, financials, and real estate companies in 1980, to 50% asset light, tech, and healthcare, unquote. I think she has a point. Now, history suggests stocks are well-positioned to keep the good times going. According to a Dow Jones market data analysis of index performances going back to 1950, when the S&P adds 8% or more in the first quarter, it finishes the rest of the year higher 94% of the time, with an average gain of 9.7% over the next three quarters. And, as I mentioned in the last segment, we were up 10.2 for the first 3 months in the S&P this year. Presidential election years, as we kind of discussed, also tend to end in stock market gains. And since 1950, to reiterate, the S&P has risen 83% of the time in those years and averaged about a 7.3% gain in those years. And this, again, according to Dow Jones market data. So now we move on to the perspective portion of the program. I call it that because I don't know what else to call it, quite frankly. You know, but as I mentioned, the S&P, the Dow, gold, the Russell 2000 all close at record highs Thursday. And as I've also mentioned a couple times, for the quarter, the S&P has added 10.2%. That's its best first quarter gain since 2019. Keep that that date in mind. The Dow advanced 5.6%. That's its best first quarter performance since 21. And the Nasdaq ended the quarter with a jump of 9.1%. So everybody's a winner as far as the indices are concerned. Now, consumer sentiment rose in March, highest level since mid-21. Initial jobless claims have ticked down and pending home sales gained more than expected in February. And so far, year-to-date, all but one of the 11 sectors making up the S&P 500, have risen. The Russell 2000 index up more than 4%, and then a separate Russell index of value stocks outperformed its growth counterpart in the past month. Now, in March, energy stocks were the clear outperformer for the S&P. The sector was up nearly 10% in the month, followed by the materials and utility sectors, those having gained 6 and 5.9% respectively. So if energy is going up, that, of course, will keep some pressure on the inflation. Now, the worst performing sector in the S&P was consumer discretionary shares. Those were down nearly 1% this month. Now, this may be a surprise. The worst performing stock in the entire S&P 500 in the first quarter? Tesla. Down 29%. No one falls out of love quite like Wall Street, you know. The electric vehicle company is lower today than it was 3 years ago. The whole electric vehicle and ESG sectors have been under significant pressure of late. Now, the traditional fourth anniversary gift, now there's a reason I'm saying this, is fruit or flowers. That's the etiquette, folks tell us that. Now, that fits pretty well with this market movement since the 23rd of March, which was, what, earlier this week, I think, was 4 years to the day since the pandemic crash low. Now, today, the market is all peace, love, doves, and incense for all those happy investors enjoying nice returns and having a distinctly rosy outlook. But sit there for a minute and say, how does that compare with how you felt about the markets 4 years ago? Remember what the media was telling you then and the tone of their delivery? Well, I've been reading, watching, listening, dealing with financial journalism for more than five decades. I think it's very fair to say that it's the general approach of the more popular financial quote-unquote news outlets is one or the other of two common overviews over this entire time. One way they come at it is when the stock market has declined enough for most folks to get jittery. Financial journalism is always there to say, yes, stocks may have gotten cheaper. In reality, that means their valuations may have improved. So stocks may have gotten cheaper, but they can get a whole lot cheaper because of this, that, and other economic slash financial crises du jour. Don't buy now. Oh, gosh. Whatever you do, don't buy now. They're saying, on one hand, you know, things have declined. Folks get jittery. Don't buy now. Later, like today, for example, when the market has rallied considerably, that same financial journalism will say that stocks are overvalued. The market's too high. They can't possibly go up much further, if at all, from here. In other words, don't buy. My concern has pretty much always been that if this so-called financial news is what people are relying on for guidance, you can only conclude that there is never really a good time to buy stock. Now, not to confuse these journals with facts, but it is a matter of record, in other words, fact, that since the end of World War II, mainstream U.S. company shares have been compounding at 11% annually. Now, you gotta think that there must have been at least a couple times along in there when don't buy wasn't really very good advice. And, you know, I think that apparently journalistic financial journalists are precluded from studying history because they make these comments consistently, let's just say, that aren't in keeping with the record. In any case, you know, if you've been forced to watch daytime financial TV at any point in your life, the main focus of their program is to bring on some presumably credible person to discuss the travails of the market du jour. Like, for instance, a hot topic, pardon the term, is that why is the market overvalued? Well, let's quantify where we are first. Now, if you check the Guide to the Markets, that's published by J.P. Morgan Asset Management, the 30-year average price-to-earnings ratio for the S&P 500 is 16.6. Now, using FactSet's consensus S&P earnings estimate for this year of $245. So as of Thursday's close, the PE for the S&P 500 is 21.4. Okay, so that's more than the 30-year average, right? Okay, but for more context, let's look back to March of 2000. When the 12-month forward consensus PE was 25.2, or even in January of 22, when, just like now, it was 21.4. So yeah, we're above average on the PE, but it's nowhere near unprecedented. It's not like we've never been here before. And further, PEs are not just the be-all, end-all of how to determine value in the marketplace, for what it's worth. So here's a question for our TV guests. Have you found valuation to be effective in timing the market? Well, use whatever math or statistical data you wish. You won't be able to find evidence to prove that it is. And that's because there's no way to time the markets, if for no other reason that you can't determine where the economy is going or when it's going to get there. According to Mr. Charlie Munger, who was, until he recently passed away, Mr. Buffett's partner, he said that successful long-term stock investing is first and foremost about compounding. And according to him, the first rule of compounding is never to interrupt it unnecessarily. Oh, say by making emotional responses to news, for example. And those distressed moments of mass fear and urgent asset liquidation, after those have happened, the market has done what it typically does following a panic. It delivered profits far above average. The four-year total return for the S&P since March 23rd, 2020, about 150% or 25.7% annualized. And that includes the 25% drop from high to low in 2022. So for those having nosebleeds saying the market's too high, you know, saying that this vertical distance in the markets that we've traveled since then, not to mention this most recent 27% surge since last October without even a 2% wiggle, has even optimistic investors checking that market fuel gauge for an idea of how much is left in that tank. Well, the 25% annualized return of the past 4 years quite closely resembles the four-year pace of gains the S&P logged off the March 09 global financial crisis bottom and the August 82 kickoff to the great 80s, 90s golden era for stock, and boy, they sure were. Those were both generational bottoms from levels first seen more than a decade earlier, of course, while the 2020 low was more a brief, ugly blip in an ongoing bull market. Still, after the fourth year from the bottom, those earlier rallies somewhat slowed but kept chugging along for a while, just stretching the proverbial market tape measure back to the October 2022 low, which was set during the inflation surge and the Fed's tightening counteroffensive. The current rally is pretty unremarkable compared with the average path of the past 11 bull cycles, with the typical path forward less steep climb. Market behavior also does not display the hallmarks nearing a decisive lasting peak. The four-month 25% gain in the benchmark is overwhelmingly associated with further gains, as is a 5% or better S&P 500 gain in the first quarter of the year, again, up 10.2% in the first quarter. Last Thursday, we had the greatest number of S&P 500 stocks hitting a 52-week high in 3 years. The folks at Renaissance Macros note that rarely do we see a market peak with coincidental peak in 52-week highs. Similarly, the Bespoke Investment Group counts 7 prior times the index has gone at least 100 days without a 2% setback, and it was higher 6 months later each time. More qualitatively, this is a bull market. In a bull market, the overshoots occur to the upside, so a rally being ahead of itself certainly isn't fatal. We've had 2 cyclical bear markets in the past 4 years, more than the typical frequency, and the S&P 500 is only 9% higher than it was 2 years ago. That's hardly any bubblicious heights. You know, and the market has broadened out. Industrials, home builders, even energy and basic materials starting to show life. Earnings growth will need to catch up to become more broad, and there's at least the potential for fundamental catch-up. Warren Pies of 314 Research points out that only 37% of the S&P 500 shares have their earnings at two-year highs. We have an economy that keeps surprising with its resilience, ongoing corporate earnings growth, helpful treasury yields, global stock indexes finally confirming U.S. strength with their own record highs, the frenzied continued AI build-out, and a Fed looking for an opening to ease policy into this bounty of blessing. Now, it may not be much of a wall of worry for the market to climb compared to 6 months ago, but for now, the good news is doing the trick. You know, and finally, Benjamin Graham, Mr. Buffett's mentor, said, "The best way to measure your investing success is not by whether you're beating the market, by whether you put in place a financial strategy and a behavioral discipline that will likely get you to where you want to go," unquote. So I hope this has proven helpful to you. I very much enjoy doing it, and I hope that you enjoy listening to it. So we will be back live and in radio color next Saturday, and hopefully we'll have some good market news to pass on to you. I thank you very much for listening. And so please come back next Saturday at 9 for more money management. This is Mike Mayo, and we are powered by the Opus 111 Group. And happy Easter, folks.
Join us again next week at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Mike Mayo, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Have a question, comment, or want to find out if you'd be a good fit with Opus 111? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investment involves risk and is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.